I remember when you were down and you needed a helping hand. I came to feed you, but now that I need you, you won't give me a second glance. Now I'm calling on citizens from all over the world. This is Captain America calling. I built you up when you were down on your knees, so will you catch me now? I'm falling.
Welcome to a special Captain America Civil War edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and while I was all ready to say with me as always, the Rogers to my Stark and the lightness to my Dark, it's Dan. This will actually be a Dan-less podcast tonight. Or is it Dan-free, or non-Dan, or I don't know, not sure. Well, now that half of our listeners have probably switched this off, because they're probably thinking, no Dan, no dice, and whatever. But for those of you who have remained, there is some good news. The All-Star Squad here is in total Avengers mode, as Vicky, Jason, and Cade have assembled together this evening. Welcome aboard once again, guys.
Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Good evening. I think Dan is locked up on the raft. Somebody should go get him.
Why would they call that big thing a raft? That's just silly. No, anyway. Now, we're not going to be doing a recap or rundown of the entire film because, well, first of all, that's insane. And also, based on the box office numbers, I'm pretty sure anyone and everyone listening to this podcast has already seen the movie once or even 10 times at this point. But we are going to share our thoughts about what we enjoyed the most about this film, you know, and we might chat about it a little bit in the grand Marvel scheme of things as well, as maybe a few of the odd parallels between this and a certain other major superhero clash that crashed into cinemas earlier this year. We might even find a few things we might have liked a little bit better if handled a certain way. I'm not really sure about that one. That might be a toughie for this film. But before we get to all those things that either tickled or tantalized us about this movie, because I do think it's safe to say, am I right in saying that we all either really, really liked or even maybe loved this movie? Am I correct in that assumption here?
Yeah, I loved it. I'll say that. Yes.
Jason.
I loved it too.
Okay, you can feel the love on this one, which I'm going to say is probably already decidedly different than how we might have felt about Age of Ultron, where I think we were at least... We didn't hate it, but I think there was some misgivings about it a little bit. But before we begin, I did, and as silly as I feel even asking this question, for each one of you, and we'll do this in, we'll do ladies first, we'll do Vicky, Kay, Jason in this one. If you could each let me know, or let the listeners know, fuck me, whether you were Team Cap or Team Iron Man before the movie, and where your loyalties might have felt afterwards. So take it away, Vic.
Before the movie, I was kind of a tentative Team Cap just because I didn't want to go into the movie with too much of an opinion formed, but afterwards I was solidly Team Cap.
Interesting. Okay.
I was Team Iron Man because he's Tony Stark and he's Iron Man. Sorry, that's how I feel about it. The problem is, after the movie, I felt less like I wanted to take a side. Like, seeing the movie made me feel more divided in who was right, who was wrong, which I think is probably the thing about that movie that I find the most interesting. So by the end of it, I wasn't on either side at that point. I actually came out of it not on a side.
Interesting.
I went in solid Team Cap, came out solid Team Cap. Captain America all the way.
Interesting. Well, I guess I should say my own loyalties. I went in as Team Cap, and I came out... I can't believe I'm going to say this. I think I was leaning more Team Iron Man when I left the film. And I'm not just saying that because it's different than everybody else. I think the film did such a marvelous job of showing how both perspectives were logical and made sense from the outset, And then what happens by the end of the movie, I was like, yeah, I kind of feel like I want to side more with this guy than the other one. So, hence my falling on Team Iron Man. Though I could totally see myself waffling a bit and being where Kate is. I kind of feel myself doing that. I just felt, just to even things out, I felt like I needed to go with Iron Man on this one. All right. Now that that incredibly silly business is out of the way, let's get to the reason we're actually here to finally talk about Captain America Civil War. Now, before we start chatting about all the things that we enjoyed or found fascinating about the film, just to get a little bit of paperwork done here, just to remind people, the movie was directed by Joe and Anthony Russo, who had also directed the previous Captain America. Did they just did Winter Soldier, or did they do First Avenger also?
They did Winter Soldier.
But it was but the writing team of Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, they had written both of the previous Captain America movies, as well as, I guess, Thor Dark World. But we'll forgive them that because of how good the Captain America movies have been. So, if we're going to talk about a movie like this, you know, this is like a superhero movie with about as many bells and whistles as I think we've ever seen, and more, we should probably start with the lead, or in this case, maybe even the co-leads, you know, Iron Man and Captain America. And since his name is in the title, and even though we can make the case that this is really maybe more an Avengers movie than a Captain America movie, too bad. Still, it's a Captain America movie first and foremost, so let's talk about Cap. For me personally, I've always felt Captain America is one of those characters that if he's not handled just right, he can come off as being really corny or even worse, jingoistic, you know, the overly patriotic kind of themes that go on with Captain America. And I'll admit, way back when they first cast Chris Evans, you know, we mainly knew him as the guy who played the Human Torch in all those awful Fantastic Four movies. I was a little skeptical. But I would say, maybe more than any of the other Marvel heroes, they've done such a wonderful job of bringing this character to life. And really, by the time we've gotten to this film, it's been really clever about his name and what he embodies, America. Because it's an ideal that's obviously been tainted and trampled upon, not just in these films, but it's really a commentary on what's going on in the world today, quite frankly, which I find much more fascinating than I would have ever expected from a comic book movie in general, especially a Marvel one, because, you know, I'm a DC guy. But for these films, you know, outside of maybe Guardians of the Galaxy or even Ant-Man, I think the Captain America films have been the best and most complex of all the MCU movies. You know, I mean, they had me with his World War II origin story because I'm a sucker for period films to begin with. Now, Jason, now I know that just based on our conversations about The Flash and our mutual admiration for, you know, the Golden Age Jay Garrick, someone I think we have both at one time or another kind of likened to a Captain America-like character, that one of the main appeals of the, I'm saying MCU instead of Marvel Cinematic Universe because it's just too many syllables for someone with my speech impediment to handle quite often. I think it's been Captain America for both of us. Am I right about that? I mean, I felt like that was like one of the major things you really wanted to talk about here.
No, you're absolutely correct, and you really hit it on the head when you said that they've really nailed the role with Chris Evans. He is the Captain America, and he will be the Captain America from this point forward. You know, even if they decide to recast the role, this is it. He's giving the performance that all the others are going to be measured against. There's no contest, even from the start, when he was, quote, Skinny Steve. He didn't need to be big and bulk, buff to portray Captain America's ideals, like when he jumped on the grenade and everybody else ran. You know, just as an aside, going to one of my digressions, it's Joe Johnston that did the first Avenger.
Thank you. Right.
Thanks. He also did the Rocketeer, and that's why you got... That's why the two films are similar in their tone.
And they've got that great, lovely retro feel to them as well. Yeah, Rocketeer. Rocketeer's a really good movie. I haven't seen that in a long time. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. And another thing is, what really sold me on this movie as a great movie for Captain America is towards the end, after when they're in the big climactic fight, Bucky is down, Iron Man's got Steve on the ropes, and he gets up and he does the, I could do this all day. That is a direct callback to the first movie when he is being, when he is skinny and he's getting beaten up by a bully. And he says the same thing. He's not going to back down to a bully. And in that moment, I thought, ah, he sees Tony as a bully.
That's
what really sold me on it.
I love the connection between those two films. I love, and it's kind of fun when you're in a movie theater, especially if you saw it like the first, within the first day or two, and that, you know, people might not have been aware of that moment. How the people in the theater who actually recognize the callback and they get a little cheer from it, like, yeah, that's the Cap we remember. Now, Vicky, as I understand it, you, especially during that scene, were you more than just a little worried that Cap might not even survive this movie? Am I correct about that?
I was. I was very worried because, you know, I had kind of done a little research beforehand, kind of just about the storyline from Civil War in the comics. And I know that, you know, spoiler for anyone who doesn't know this, but Cap actually dies at the end of Civil War in the comics. And... and just that fight scene with, you know, with Tony, Bucky, and Cap was so intense, and it honestly got me worried that Cap was gonna die there.
I'll admit that I was aware that I don't know much about a lot of the Marvel stories over the last 10-15 years, but I had heard it somewhere down the line that Captain America had quote-unquote died in the comics. And I totally did go into this movie thinking they were going to kill him off. And I kept thinking, oh, that's going to be one more parallel to something I'll be talking about later in this podcast. Oh, no. So I was very thrilled that they decided not to go that what would have been, I think, a rather lame route here. So, but I do understand what you were thinking, because I had that thought through most of the movie. You know, I kept going, oh, they're going to kill him. They're going to kill him. I know they're going to kill him. Because I hadn't been spoiled by anything yet. And I was so happy to see that they didn't go that route.
Yeah,
well, you could say I'm sorry. I was going to say they metaphorically killed Captain America because they made him drop his shield. But that's neither here nor there.
It's all about the metaphors. Go on.
Yeah, but no, I do think it would have been an interesting choice because there. I don't know if... Like, they kind of set up that maybe Bucky could take up that mantle because there's kind of been some chatter elsewhere with Sebastian Stan about possibly becoming Captain America. So it would have been very interesting. I don't know. Joss Whedon wasn't part of this movie, so we didn't get the major character death.
Very nice. Well, I'm assuming Sebastian Stan's going to be on ice for a while, so I think personally that it would have been strange to kill off the Steve Rogers Captain America character, even if it would only be a temporary comic book like death, because you know we're building up to like the biggest Marvel event of all. I think you want your main Captain America involved in that. I think you want him in the Infinity War. I'd be like, cause otherwise, I'd be like, where's Captain America? Even if it was one of these other people assuming the role, it still wouldn't be the same. So I'm glad. Once again, I'm glad they didn't go that route. Well, since we chatted about Captain America, we should also be talking about the flip side of this story, because in a way, this movie really could have been, you know, Captain America slash Iron Man, you know, then, you know, Civil War, because it really could have been either one of their movies for a good chunk of it. Now, what's funny is that I'm not really a big fan of either of the Iron Man sequels, but I will be the first to admit that Robert Downey Jr. might actually be the most perfectly cast superhero possibly since Christopher Reeve put on the red and blue tights back in the 70s. I mean, he might annoy me sometimes when I watch him on an award show or on talk shows. Maybe he gets too much into the Marvel versus DC thing and he just makes me feel like I'm 12 years old again and gets me all angry or something. But, oh my God, he is just so perfect in that role. And in this movie, I think he's dynamite. I think this is the best I've seen him, I think, since maybe the first Avengers movie. So even ahead of, like, Age of Ultron, Iron Man. Now, Cade, I know that that was probably one of the major aspects of this film. As you said before, you were Team Iron Man when you went into the movie, was the story of old Shellhead. So how did you feel about how he was, you know, that's such a big part of this movie. How did you react to that, and what was your feelings about it?
One of the things I liked is, even though it's a Captain America movie, how much carry through from the Iron Man story we've gotten, because this is really the point where Iron Man is broken. And by that, I mean Tony Stark at the end of the first movie put Iron Man around himself as a way to protect himself for everything. He felt invincible because of that suit. And then Iron Man 2 and Iron Man 3 showed progressively that would be broken down to the point, and then in Avengers 2, broken down even further to where that suit can't protect Tony Stark. He has to embrace who he is and put it out there. And in this movie, you see him do things that's not about being Iron Man. It's like when he funds all of MIT. He's trying to do more than protect the world, because he realizes putting on that suit's not the best way to do it. And that's why when he goes through in this movie and you see what he's saying, you're like, I can't disagree. He sees this as a way to help the world instead of what they're doing. Because every time he's tried to help the world, it's called chaos. I mean, he basically created Ultron with his own, I'm going to save the world. He realizes he can't do it that way. And he sees a way that maybe there's another way it can be done. And that's why he's so behind it, because he's seen the flaw in the way he's thought before, how he was invincible. He's not the invincible Iron Man in these movies. And at the end of the movie, he is just as broken as Steve was about it. And it was good to see that even in the Captain America movie, they could break down Iron Man. So at some point, you can build him back up. Because I don't think he's going to put that suit on anytime soon. It just doesn't seem like something he's going to do, because he feels that's a problem for him now. He relied on it too much, and it made him not think straight about how to handle situations. And that was the thing about the movie. It gave you a chance to see that. He was just as flawed a hero as you could possibly have in this movie. He knew he had screwed up, but he has that personality where people don't want to believe it, don't want to buy in, because they still can't believe Tony Stark is thinking outside of himself. And when those two are together in those scenes, it's just like him and Chris Evans as the two characters. It's amazing to watch those two work as Tony and Steve going at it. You just believe it more and more. And when at the end of that fight scene, Steve sees Tony as a bully, but Tony just sees the man he called a friend for this time period, who probably felt was like one of his closest friends in the world, because he doesn't have any, had a secret that he held back from him. That's why he was really angry at Cap. It's not so much he knows Bucky killed his parents, but the fact that he knows Steve knew and Steve didn't even tell him. He had to find out this way is what really broke his heart, because he was brokenhearted about that. He didn't want it to come to that, but that's what happened, because he felt betrayed by his own friend. And it destroyed him at the end. So he's a broken man going out of this movie. And that's an interesting thing, because some of the best Iron Man stories are when he is broken, to see him come to that point where he builds himself back up to become Iron Man again. And I hope we get to see some of that some other way. Even if it's in the Infinity Wars where he builds back up, it should be good to see that.
Interesting.
That's a good point. And, you know, he really is broken at the end. I agree with you completely. At the very end, when they're at the compound, it's just Vision and himself and War Machine, who's paralyzed from the waist down. He has to have mechanics to walk. It's a really, really low point for him. You know, he's got all the toys, but he doesn't have anybody to sit there and to be with him. I have to say a couple of things about Iron Man. Number one, the CGI for the young Robert Downey Jr. was amazing.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, it was so really scary. I was like, how did they pull that off?
They did the effect that they did in Ant-Man with Michael Douglas.
Yeah, with Michael Douglas.
They did him it by better. Like 25 years. Yeah, he looked the way he did like in the mid-80s. It was really weird.
It was. I was like, are we seeing a young Tony? I thought they were going to like put a new actor or something as a young Tony Stark. But no, my God, it was Robert Downey Jr. from the, like you said, the mid-80s when he was doing those teen comedies and stuff. And it was great. They actually made me think of Tony as not completely hateable in this movie, which is something that they needed to do, because I know we don't like to talk about the comics, but in the comics he was just completely god awful and no sympathy with him whatsoever. In this one, you actually do get to care about him for all the reasons that Kate said. And, you know, there are reasons for following the Accords that you can understand. You right. may not agree with it, but you understand it.
Right. Well, from what I understand, at best, the story is extremely loosely from the comics, but not really. I mean, it's got some things in common, but from what I understand, it's not really much of an adaptation of what they did in the comics, which I'm always going to be fine with. You know, like, that's fine with me because I personally don't care.
Yeah. There's only one scene that's from the comics, and that's when Iron Man's firing against the shield towards the end in the final battle. That's the only thing.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
The thing that's really great here is what they accomplished in this movie as far as these two characters and being in opposition to each other is that this was so well crafted over the course of several films. Both their relationship and the other plot points that have led the government to do what they're doing. You know, and so by that stretch, those Accords, well, it does make sense. Because I think General Ross or whoever kind of compares them. It's like having these weapons of mass destruction, but no one has control over them. No one takes responsibility for them. And when you see them watching the videos of all the sites of battles, whether it be New York or Sokovia or wherever, you realize that that tens of thousands of people died. There's probably no real way around that. You know, it's kind of the comments that we used to make about, like, Man of Steel. At least here, they're not just addressing it. This is the reason why this story is happening. And it really works. And you do understand both reasons on both sides. I think they did such a good job of making this conflict believable and understandable. I don't think at any point in the film I was ever questioning it. And then when we get to that big reveal in the third act, holy crap, how I didn't see that coming, I don't know, but that fuels it even more. It's like what Cade was saying, both of you were saying, about it being the lie. It's not just what it was, but also the lie that is fueling Tony's anger. And that's kind of why I think I decided to go on Team Iron Man by the end of the film, quite frankly.
Yeah, I will say... I wasn't against the idea of the Accords. It was, I think, how it was done. And I agreed with Steve's argument that, they're going to have to answer to these people with agendas. And that was my biggest problem with it. But I think that they did a really great job of, everyone had a valid argument for, why they felt the way they did and which side that they landed on.
Right. Exactly. I mean, the best debate is always going to be the one where you can see equally good reasons on either side. And yeah, I mean, I could totally see Steve Rogers' point of view, and I would agree with him. And then I start thinking about, like, well, they got a good point too. And him saying, like, well, people who are in charge are going to have agendas. And I want someone to say, hey, you know what? You were a soldier. So maybe, why would you be objecting to working for the government, even though it actually wouldn't be the U.S. government? It would be some sort of amalgamation of the United Nations or something, which really means nothing would ever get done. But, that's neither here nor there. All right. Well, I'm going to say if Iron Man and Captain America were clearly at the core of this story, I think, and I'm sure we'll continue talking about them throughout this podcast. We're not saying goodbye to Tony and Steve, but maybe we can start moving a little bit to the outer rings, one by one, kind of like an atom or a solar system or something. So I'm going to say, and the first step beyond them would be those who are closest to them. And in this film's case, I'm thinking, Winter Soldier or Bucky Barnes, I guess, and the Falcon, Sam Wilson, right? That's his name.
Yep.
I think one of the really unexpected delights of this film, one of the things I can honestly say not expecting, were the scenes involving those two. Because I'll be honest with you, I like the Falcon and Sam Wilson, Anthony Mackie in a couple other films. He didn't overly impress me, but he didn't disappoint me either. And I wasn't a huge fan of the Sebastian Stan Winter Soldier character in Winter Soldier, as much as I really did love that film. But I thought they were really something special in this film. And I know that was on Cade's list of his favorite things about this movie. So say more about it than I just did, Cade. Thank you, please.
Besides the fact you get to see two people who are Steve's most trusted allies at two different times in his life, the thing that made it so interesting was, if you've ever had two friends in your life, best friends at different times, then introduce them and immediately watch that they don't get along and they're almost wary of how each other behaves, that was Sam and Bucky. They knew they both liked Steve a lot. Sam would say he's probably Steve's best friend at this point. That's the guy he's like, when he said in the bar, he goes, when they shoot at you, they shoot at me. You sure you want to do this? That's a man who's like, I'm with you 100% at this point. And Bucky doesn't know how he feels about it. He's like, Steve, I don't know what I could turn any moment, but I'm still trusting you because you were my friend. I can kind of still feel that. But whenever they were together, the scene in the car where Bucky goes, can you move forward? And Sam's like, nope. Sam is just like, I'm not giving you anything. Steve may think you're his best friend and trust you, but I don't have to give you anything. I don't owe you anything. I'm doing this because he asked me to. And that was the crux of anything between those two, is that they're not going to get along. They don't have to be best friends. They're both in it for Steve at this point. And it's the loyalty to Steve that drives those two. Bucky more so because he knows Steve's going to be the one who's protecting him the most. Sam because this is a guy who pulled him out of nothing in Winter Soldier. Sam was just not had anything to do. Cap gave him a mission. They became that mission together. They were working together. And to see them butt heads constantly about it was just one of the little joys in the movie. There, every little interaction between the line where they're both laying on the floor after the Spider-Man fight and Sam goes, I hate you. That was just a funny moment between the two. It breaks some tension in that scene, but you believe him. He does hate him. He doesn't like him one bit, but they will work together because that's what Steve wants them to do. And that through line for their little bit in the movie was one of the better part, one of the more entertaining parts for me, that I really enjoyed seeing those two go back and forth like that. Cause I've had friends who had that interaction with each other. They would hang around because they both liked me, but I knew they hated each other. And the only reason they did it is because I was there. And that's how they are with Steve. He's that thing that bonds them as much as they don't like each other.
Nice. Go on, Jason.
I was going to say, well, Cade took what I was going to jump on there with the scene at the airport. He got that covered, so I don't have anything to say. So, go ahead, Scott.
I'm glad I paused for you to have nothing to say.
Yeah.
I'll just say that, to echo what Cade was saying to a very slight extent, it was just unexpected to see things that made me smile or laugh that involved the Bucky Barnes character, because I certainly did not expect any moment in this movie to be like that, just based on what I had known of the character in the previous movie. So I like that not just the performers, but the directors and the writers were secure enough in the story they were telling. Like, you know what? As deep and heavy as a lot of the story could be, we can still give you some levity, even with a character that you just wouldn't expect it from, which would be that character at this point. So I really enjoy that a lot. They were able to do that without screwing up the tone of the movie at all.
I really enjoyed how much kind of like character development we got with Bucky in this movie, because, you know, in Winter Soldier, he, I think, maybe had two lines, I think, you know, and a lot of it was, the rest of it was just kind of physical presence, whereas here you got to see him trying to return, you know, get some semblance of his humanity back. You know, he's trying to, you know, establish he did not want to do any of those things. And, you know, he's terrified that everything Hydra did to him is still in his brain, and it can all just be turned back on with, you know, a couple keywords.
Right.
And I think that, you know, the best solution that they, you know, he could come up with for the time being was to, you know, put himself on ice again, and, you know, so that they can figure this, you know, until they can, you know, figure how to get this out of his head, if it's at all possible.
Or wear earplugs. No. It's funny. There's something you said that I feel is a nice little segue to my next point I wanted to talk about. When you talked about how there really wasn't that much to the Bucky Barnes character in Winter Soldier, because it was the whole Manchurian Candidate, which I believe is a joke they make at some point in this movie, if I'm not mistaken. I think Tony calls him Manchurian Candidate somewhere.
He does, yeah.
Excellent. I love all Manchurian Candidate references, and I don't mean the crappy movie remake from a few years ago. Anyway, back to what I was talking about. But they really, Winter Soldier was really more of a cipher, because he didn't have any real dialogue beyond a couple lines. He was just his automaton, a killing machine, whatever. So I'm looking at this movie, which, although it's technically not a sequel to Age of Ultron, it's supposed to be the next Captain America movie, it is sort of a major follow-up to that film, because we reestablished some characters that we met in that film. And one of them was Wanda, you know, the Scarlet Witch, who I thought they really didn't do much with her in that movie. I always thought she was kind of a cipher or even just a plot device in Age of Ultron. I mean, to this day, I still don't know why she and her brother allied themselves with Ultron in that mess, but that's a conversation from an older podcast. But I thought she really came into her own in this film as a real and even truly empathetic character. And speaking of characters they introduced, they brought back into this movie when it comes to empathy, is not one of the subplots of this entire film the Vision and his humanity? I mean, not to mention those sweaters he's wearing throughout the movie. Now, Vicky, I know, bouncing right back to you here, I know that you've had some thoughts about this and how they've handled relationship issues, especially compared to some previous MCU films. So how do you think they did here? And you can feel free to compare and contrast, because there's someone else I want to bring up while you're talking about this.
I really liked how you what they did with you know, Wanda and the Vision. You know, like they were saying, they gave Wanda a whole lot more to do in this movie. That, you know, there was more character development and whatnot. But one of the good things I'm glad that they did not do was kind of, you know, any kind of you know, romance plot. Because, like, the stuff with Wanda and Vision was very subtle. It was more, you know, laying groundwork for stuff in future films. Because, you know, in the comics, Wanda and Vision have this whole romance, and they get, like, married and stuff. And that, I mean, if they choose to do that, that's fine. You know, it's not completely necessary if they do, but, you know, this was basically they're just kind of maybe, you know, feeling each other out, so to speak. but it was so much better, I think, than Age of Ultron and the unnecessary plot you know, romance between Natasha and Bruce, because that was very out of left field. It's like, you know, no inclination in, you know, between them before that there would be anything like this. Whereas, you know, at least with Wanda and Vision, there's kind of the comics history with them. So, yeah.
I think the stuff with Natasha and Banner that they really brought to the forefront in Age of Ultron, I wasn't totally against it, because I did feel there was, one could really make the case there were these very slight hints in some previous moments, but it just seemed to be a lot too much too soon, maybe. So yeah. I agree with what they're doing here with Wanda and the Vision, because obviously, Natasha and Banner are both in their own way outcasts or misfits or people who can't really blend in quite as well. I mean, she should be able to, but we understand Natasha's background, especially if you've watched Agents, not Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agent Carter. But what's interesting more so with Wanda and the Vision is that, you know, he's artificial life to begin with. So it's fascinating to see him even be able to consider the things that involve humans and emotions or whatever. And her, well, I know that legally they can't use the word mutant in these movies, but we know that's what she is. so there is that. I mean, another thing that I but going back to Age of Ultron, which I was not as thrilled with, but one of the things I do recall enjoying the most about Age of Ultron was how they handled Hawkeye, because he really became a major player in that film, because he kind of got left out of everything in the first Avengers movie. But I thought they really did a nice job with him here, even if he didn't have quite as much screen time. I thought he really made his presence known, especially one key moment for every comic book geek out there, which I'm sure someone's going to mention before the night is out. And I know that you're a kind of a Hawkeye fan yourself, and as well as certain other people here, even without the purple outfit. So,
thank God that it was purple in this one, though.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean. I wouldn't mind the outfit being purple if it didn't have the big, you know, late 1960s Catwoman mask as part of it as well.
I love the mask.
That's ridiculous. It makes no as little sense as it makes for Green Arrow to be wearing a hood that would screw up with his peripheral vision. Him wearing that weird mask where you'd constantly see that out of the corner of your eye. It would screw up your aim. Anyway.
And I don't even need the mask. The fact the suit was purple was enough to make me a happy person for the suit.
All right. I'll give you, since Prince died, I'll give you that. So anyway, so but Vicky, like I was saying, I know that you were especially appreciative of how they handled, how Jeremy Renner handled the part in this movie. So if you had anything more to say about that, feel free.
Yeah, no, I was incredibly happy because this was the most Hawkeye-like he has been in any of the MCU films that he's been in. He's the quippy and, you know, snarky with the snarky comments and everything. They were just totally on point, which, you know, people who know his character from the comic books know he's constantly doing that. You know, one of my favorite scenes was when he was in the raft and Tony comes and visits him and Clint just loses it on him. He calls him out on everything. Everything he said was completely true. Another thing that was really good is how they kept the friendship between you know, Clint and Natasha, even when they're at, you know, having this big fight in the airport scene. The two of them fighting each other, and you know, Clint or Natasha asks, you know, are we still friends? And he replies, depends how hard you hit me. They understood that this whole situation wasn't personal. It was just business, and it was not going to get in their way, the way of the friendship between the two of them. Even if, you know, Steve and Tony were willing to come to blows and more over this, over the whole situation.
Doesn't that really make sense for those two characters as well? Because they were two, as opposed to, you know, quote unquote superheroes, they were more like, I don't want to say, I'm not going to call him an assassin, but they were much like, you know, trained agents who worked with missions. Wasn't that the way that they've established both those characters?
They were S.H.I.E.L.D. agents. You were told to do this, you're told to do that, that's what you do. And that's kind of what they're doing.
Yeah, and, you know, Wanda called him out on pulling his punches, but he's like, you know, but, you know, he wasn't gonna, you know, sacrifice his friendship and, you know, potentially hurt her, though. I don't think he really could have, you know.
Well, She was pregnant during the making of this movie, though. It's fascinating.
No.
I think she was.
No, she was
pregnant during Age of Ultron.
Yeah, Age of Ultron.
Are you sure she wasn't pregnant during a part of this as well?
No, it was either
Captain
America 2.
All right, just
or Age of Ultron.
Just to be clear, the reason why I'm saying it, because there's a scene where her head is CGI'd onto a body. I was able to see that. So I was wondering if that might have been why they did that. So, all right, I'm gonna do a little fact checking on this myself, because there's the scene when they're in the church and she walks down the aisle towards him. If you watch that scene closely, I am 90% sure that's not her body. There's a moment or two, a little glimmer or a glimpse where I can see, oh, I think they've put her head on someone else's body here, and I can only think of one reason why you do that. So, again, I have to go. I've not gotten the chance to go see the movie again like I had planned to. I'm sure at least. Kate, have you seen this movie a couple times now?
Twice. Yes.
Only twice. Ugh. Where's Force Awakens, Kade?
I'm ashamed of myself.
Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked with that. I was just curious about. I was about to move on, but I would be remiss. Would one of you two please mention the, even I know it's an iconic thing that they were able to do that involved Hawkeye in this movie? Because I think I saw it first in a trailer, I can't remember. And I went, oh my God, that's pretty cool. I have the toy right in front of me. It's in my hands right now. In fact, I'll explain what I'm talking about right when one of you guys say it. I know Jason probably really wants to say it, so Jason, be my guest.
It's Ant-Man hopping aboard Hawkeye's arrow and being shot through the air.
There was about 5 seconds. I was going to steal that from you and just say it before you could. I'm just going to let you know.
And they didn't just do it for a cool visual. I mean, it actually had a purpose for him doing it, which was even better.
Fabulous purpose. Just to explain, about a year or 2 years ago, when I was starting to sell off parts of my collection, you know, to pay the rent and such, one of the first things I decided to get rid of was all my Marvel figures, because, you know, Marvel. and one of the figures I was happy to sell off was my Hawkeye figure, right? Because I hate that outfit and so on and so forth. No, I'm just saying that just to piss off Kate now. Now, I can't remember how much I sold it for. Let's say $20. I don't remember. And it wasn't until about maybe a week or two later, the person I sold it to said, hey, was this the Hawkeye that came with the arrow that had Ant-Man on it? Because I don't know if they all did or only some of them did. I wasn't sure. And I said, oh, I don't think so. I don't think I ever had that. So fast forward about, I don't know, a year and a half, cleaning out one of my night table drawers, and I found it. And I think I contacted the guy to say I would send it back to him. And that might have been right around the time when my father passed away and I kind of forgot about it. And then he contacted me like a week after and I'm like, hey, dude, I can't really concentrate on this right now. I'm in mourning. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry, man. Because I really didn't want to give it to him. So I have these little odd little things that are all in front of my computer here. It's like, you know, a little tiny Adam figure sitting in a JLA chair, a little boxing glove arrow. And next to the boxing glove arrow from Green Arrow, I still have the Hawkeye arrow with Ant-Man on it. So it's like, might be my only Marvel artifact I own right now. Jeez. Okay, so when we start realizing how long this podcast is, we can blame it on that story. So anyway. Now, in some ways, I think I've been saving what some may have felt was the best for last, or at least we're looking at the two that got more people talking about this movie than just about anything else. Both were handled about as well as anyone might have dreamed, considering this film. Good Lord, this film was jam-packed with story and characters. So let's first talk about a whole new player that we've never seen before in live action. The Black Panther. All I'm going to say is, wow, they truly did a much better job of introducing that character than I expected them to do. Even if part of it had to be the traditional, oh, look, a hero loses a parent again. But beyond that, I was really impressed. Now, Kate, I happen to know that this is one of the most notable things in the film for you as well.
this is my favorite part of this movie. I can honestly say, coming out of that movie, as good as the rest of the movie was, the fact that Black Panther was in this movie and was done so amazingly well, like straight off the page, T'Challa, just made me so happy. All the smallest little details they had gotten so right. And one of the things I want to talk about is, in Wakandan stories and all the comic books, it's realized that nation has shut itself off from the rest of the world. It is advanced like 50 to 60 years ahead of every other place in the world because it shut itself off. It keeps people out. It's very insular in the way it wants to. It keeps itself safe. That's how it protects itself. So for a character like him to come out so much as he did, it would have to take his father dying. That's the only way, and it's just in the comics, it's the only way it's believable for something that personal to draw him out of his country to become what he did and take on that mission. And that was why I forgave it in this case, because that was the motivation for him to put on the suit, to take on that warrior's mantle that is passed down to the Black Panthers through that family and through that country. And the minute he puts on the suit, you see the suit. And it's one of those things I might feel some people might not realize what's so special about his suit. I think it's quickly mentioned about the vibranium, but his suit is made of the same stuff Captain America's shield is. Right. And if that's the amazing part. The rest of the world got it and made a solid shield. His suit moves with him. His suit is vibranium, so when he gets shot, it absorbs it. When he's fighting Spider-Man or when he's fighting Bucky, and Bucky goes to punch him and he stops it, and Bucky realizes what's going on here, because T'Challa is just a normal guy with a special – he's a trained man. He's got athletic skills, but he's not super strong. But the suit is what makes him able to fight guys like this, because the suit absorbs it just like Cap's shield would. And that was the best part, is like they kept all of that there. Every bit of things he does, it's the Black Panther. You get more – you just want to see the movie – even more to see the country. And I think those little bits you get about their country in the movie lead the thing where he ends up taking Bucky back even more, because he realizes Bucky was just a pawn in someone's game and he can't hold it against him because it wasn't him. I want to help this guy because I was a pawn in someone else's game. My father died to get me to do something and he felt used by that. And he can kind of feel how Bucky feels, and is like, I want to help him, and I can help, because as he says, let them try, meaning when you go to war with Wakanda, you are in trouble. They have Quinjets like you, S.H.I.E.L.D. might have gotten. They had them before. His suit's probably not the only suit that could be in that country. It's one of the most powerful Marvel characters, and just his relationship, the history of that character. And it's one of those characters that I'm so excited is in the movie universe now, because there's so much that can be done. And I'm losing words at how excited I actually am about Black Panther. That's how excited I got about him. That's it. I don't have to say anymore. I think I've said it all I can about him. And the fact Chadwick Boseman just destroyed how good that character was. He shows up and you immediately are like, he's him. I don't have any questions. He's perfect as that character.
Okay, so just so for everyone out there, keep in mind, any of the little audio dips you might have heard during Kate speaking, that was just him being at a loss for words from time to time, that's all. I absolutely agree, and I also like the idea of that character and Boseman's performance, because I love that every character in this movie has their own different set of motivations, and they have very different personalities, but not to the point of being cartoonish, which is funny because it's a comic book movie. You'd think you'd be allowed to be cartoonish. He's not cartoonish, but he's instantly believable, but not to the point of it being like too almost like some Nolan-esque kind of thing where it's too dark, it's too down, whatever. I mean, what the resolution with his character and the villain towards the end of the film, I thought that was wonderful. It was, again, something different than what we had seen before. And
it was really good.
I really enjoyed that tremendously. It was far more satisfying than, once again, the resolution I might have expected them to go with. So I really liked how they handled that. And how he really was a truly major player, you know, the more this movie progressed.
Yeah, I agree with you. If you didn't say it, I was going to say it. His storyline, his through line throughout the whole movie is one of the more complete. Just the fact that he goes from being a vengeful person to saying he's no longer going to let it eat him up as he saves the villain was really powerful. You're not wrong. That was really powerful.
Right.
The only goofy thing I thought about it was the musical cues that they kept giving him every time he showed up.
I got something to say about the. One of the only negative things I have to say about any Marvel movie is the music, but that'll be in the final moments of our podcast, most likely. That's about as minor a thing as I can think of to knock them on.
Yeah, it was like Zamfir's pan flute kept coming on every time he came on this movie. But that's really nothing, though.
Oh, really silly question, since Cade brought up the suit being made out of the vibranium. Are his claws also made out of vibranium then?
You'd assume so.
Yes.
Because it made those gouges in Cap's shield.
Okay, because, you know, I was kind of hoping that the suit would be made out of vibranium, but the claws would be made out of adamantium. Let's just use all the wacky Marvel metals. You know? Well, maybe they're not allowed to mention that metal. I forgot. Never mind.
they're not. That's why they replaced it. Vibranium is their super metal.
What the final one more thing about Black? About to call Black Canary.
Black Canary.
Wrong show.
Oh man, wrong podcast.
Wrong universe.
Wrong everything. one of the things that the movie accomplished, which you know on the commerce side would always be one of their goals. Tell me you're not excited to see the Black Panther movie now. I mean,
pumped.
And then after this. The announcements that were made, I mean, they've got, I think it's Ryan Coogler is going to direct it, who's the guy who directed Creed. Michael B. Jordan has joined the cast of the movie. No one's sure who he's playing just yet, but which is, you know what, I don't want to know. Plus, I probably wouldn't know who the characters are anyway, so it doesn't mean anything to me. Lupita, fill in her last name because I can't pronounce it. Lupita Nyong'o? Is that
Nyong'o?
Nyong'o,
Holy shit, I got it right. Obviously not drunk tonight. Is going to be in this movie, I believe. I mean, I'm really excited to see this movie. I mean, it looks like it could be, you know, like award caliber kind of stuff. Then again, I'm thinking that about, what's the movie I'm hearing a lot about now? Oh, the next Thor movie. Wow, geez, the cast for the new Thor movie also is kind of insane, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that might be actually more insane. Like, Jeff Goldblum, what? But anyways, stay on track.
Yeah, Vicky. No. I'm just going to join the chorus of you guys. Black Panther was phenomenal. I don't think I could have enjoyed it more. And it was just kind of all the little things that they, you know, with his character that they included. Like even just like his butler, like those ladies are freaking fierce.
Oh,
like
yeah.
they could take like Natasha down with no trouble. I'm so looking forward to seeing more of them in, you know, the Black Panther movie. And then when, you know, T'Challa and Bucky were fighting, I didn't notice this. This is kind of pointed out to me later, but T'Challa's ring reacted to Bucky's arm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I forgot about that. I just love that they're running. I just love that whole running scene. And I totally believe it, because these are like they're beyond athletes at this point. I'm like, it's great. I found that to be much more exciting than just like it being just a simple car chase. I thought that just made it so much more different. And seeing him spring back and forth and whatever, really, I really loved the character. I thought the outfit looked terrific. I mean, I'm
really good.
And funny thing is, my memory of Black Panther is vague. I'll admit, you know, I have to go back to the comics I read like in the 70s, early 80s. I even remember some Jack Kirby versions of Black Panther. And wasn't there a version that had a cape at one point? Didn't he have a cape?
Yeah, he did have a different version of the outfit.
So I'm looking at this outfit, and, you know, there are some demarcations or lines that I don't know if they're actually in the comic or not, but I know why they're there when you're trying to watch a movie in live action, and so you can actually make out details. But the mask alone sold it for me. I was like, oh, I love that mask. I love the mask and then the claws. It made that character made me feel like a kid again, just watching him run around. I thought it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to be...
I was going to say the costume department did a wonderful job all around in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody's costumes look great.
Oh, yes.
Which is now the perfect place for me to go with what the thing I want to talk about the most. Last but not least, at least of the major elements of this film that we haven't mentioned, that had people yapping from coast to coast and pole to pole all around the world, I'm going to say the riskiest, the boldest move that they did in this film was to have yet another fucking reboot and reintroduction of a superhero who can finally now interact with all the other characters in the main Marvel Cinematic Universe. Obviously, I'm talking about Spider-Man. I loved this Spider-Man. I didn't just like him. I didn't just think he was cool. I fucking loved the way they did this character. I was like, okay, checklist. Boom. He's a genuine teenager. I love that. Not someone who, maybe they're supposed to be anywhere between 17 and 20, but they're being played by someone who's 10 years old and all that crap. It's a kid. And he actually sounds, oh my gosh, like he's from New York. The actor is doing a Queens accent. And I picked up on this before I watched Kevin Smith talking about it on some video somewhere, because I was in the theater going, holy shit, Spider-Man's a real New Yorker in this movie. Motherfuckers. Something that neither Garfield or Tobey Maguire ever seemed to bother with. I kept going, dude, if there was one Marvel character other than maybe Ben Grimm from the Fantastic Four who should have a New York sounding accent, it's Spider-Man. It always bothered me that, you know, Garfield didn't even make any attempt to do it. I guess he was just trying to have like an American accent to begin with. I don't know. I could probably spend the entire podcast just gushing about how much I enjoyed every aspect of this version of Spider-Man. Well, by the way, let me just take a 10-second pause to give a middle finger to the people who are whining, oh, we want Miles Morales, the new one from... I don't care. Shut up. This is a Spider-Man that would do Stan Lee and Steve Ditko proud. That's what I always think. This is a Spider-Man that the look, you know, had a really nice classic look to it. Everything from the eyes, I gotta shut up because I could just start listing things and that becomes kind of a boring kind of a podcast. You know, listing things when you're ranting and negatively, that's great podcasting. Listing things that are really good, it can be funny, but not so much. But the last thing I'll just say, and then I'm gonna throw it to, I'll pick one of you, is that more than anything else in this movie, the fact that they made me excited about a character that I could have been tired of, that they made me excited about a character like, really, you're doing another version of it? Really, another one? I am so looking forward to the new Spider-Man movie. I can't imagine I would have ever said that a few months ago. I'm still reeling from Amazing Spider-Man 2 and what a horrible piece of crap that was. But I am so looking forward to it. Plus the knowledge that Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark / Iron Man is going to be in that movie makes that just become like, that's the movie I want to see that year. I don't, that might be some DC thing, I don't care. That's the movie I want to see that year. The fact that Michael Keaton came back to the negotiations and now it sounds like he is going to be in the movie and maybe as the Vulture, which is just ridiculous since he was Birdman. I'm like, holy crap, I've got to see this movie. Marissa Tomei, yay, who cares? How does she still look that good? I've got to see that movie. I can't. There's so many things I haven't touched on, which means there's lots for you guys to talk about here, I hope. I mean, just that the fight scene and stuff alone. Oh my god. Even if everything else sucked in this movie, this, you know how we kind of, a movie I'll be talking about in a few minutes, kind of said one of the saving graces of Batman v Superman was like Wonder Woman or something. But if everything else in this movie sucked, I would still be recommending it just because how much I like Spider-Man in it. That's how much I liked it. Now I'm going to shut up. One of you people jump in. I won't even direct traffic now.
I'll jump in with something real quick about Spider-Man.
Okay.
One of the things I've seen that really question, and it's kind of a thing about the fan, is there are people going, how could Tony Stark throw an 18-year-old kid into the middle of this? That's kind of irresponsible. And I'm like, did you idiots watch the movie? Tony has seen on video of the kid being hit by a truck and just pushing it away. This is not a kid. This is not an 18-year-old you. This is a being who is as strong as Captain America and can fight him. You don't understand Spider-Man because those other stupid movies didn't show you how strong Spider-Man really is. He can go toe-to-toe with some of the Marvel's strongest characters because he's that kind of character. Spider-Man is tougher than you think he is. That's why he's such an amazing character, because he's a kid with just a powerhouse inside of that body. And that was the fun part. Tony's like going to throw him into this. He knows he can handle himself, and he does. He's fighting Falcon and Winter Soldier at the same time and giving them a run for his money. That was fun to watch. That he's goofing off. He sees this as fun. No realization in his head this could be a problem for him, because that's who Spider-Man is. Someone who, when the danger is there, it doesn't quite sink in what danger means. He's going to embrace it, and he's living it like it's an adventure. And the kid embraced that perfectly. And that's the thing I enjoyed.
Let me jump in one more time. I'm going to keep jumping in. I can't help it. So tough luck, everybody. First of all, he's... Just to establish, he's not 18. He's considerably younger than 18, which is one of the things I really loved about this. I mean,
he's got to be like 16 or something.
Yeah. Tops. 16 tops.
I went the actor's real age. I'm sorry about that.
I don't even think the actor's 18. I think he's a kid. He's genuine. Tom Holland is a kid. So it's really impressive. Can I also point out that we've had now, I really liked the first two Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies. Forget the third one. And I kind of like the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, forget the second one. But I'm going to say right here, you can stack those movies up end to end, top to bottom, whatever, however you phrase it. And that's how many, whatever number of hours you have of Spider-Man footage. And then you take whatever, however much he's in this movie. 20 minutes? 25 minutes? Something like that? Whatever. Am I wrong in saying that Spider-Man is funnier in the 20 to 25 minutes he's in this movie than... Wow, he is. He's 19. Wow. As of today, anyway. He's fucking in high school. He's not 18. Anyway, derailed my point.
No,
oh, yeah. What you're saying?
He completely is.
He's definitely funnier. He's totally funnier in this than he is in any point in those movies, and more so than any other superhero. Unless it's someone I'm forgetting. The one thing I remember when I was a little kid. Spider-Man was the one who was constantly making wisecracks when he's fighting villains, more than any other hero that I can ever remember. And the fact that he was doing this, and like it's like this is all just fun and like a joke to him, which is actually even annoying other people, which is awesome because he's annoying them, yet he can hold his own with anyone here. Anyone. All right, I'm gonna shut up. I'm gonna leave. I'm gonna guess that Jason is probably gonna mention my favorite moment, and if he doesn't, I'm gonna have to say it. So, but I'm thinking Jason's gonna say it. So go ahead, Jason.
I am. I'm gonna digress back to Cade for just a second. When Tony realizes towards the end of the fight that it's a mistake having this kid around once Spider-Man gets thrown to the ground and through the boxes, and he tells him that he's done, you're finished. I think Tony realized that this was a little bit too real for this kid, so he took him out of the fight. So in that way, Tony did act more responsible at the end. Anyway, I agree with everything you said about Spider-Man. It's fantastic. Great. Would not change a thing. You know, it's nice to have a Spider-Man that sounds like he just exited puberty. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Him and another character, Paul Rudd's Ant-Man, really added a nice bit of levity towards the middle of the movie when it was getting heavy. And it was, as soon as those two show up, the mood lightens up a little bit, and it got to be fun, you know. And even though the fight dealt with some heavy issues, it was still fun, not just because of what Spider-Man was says, but also what Ant-Man was says, especially when he gets inside of Tony's armor and says, "This is your conscience. We don't get a chance to talk much."
Hey,
which is a really funny line.
since I think a lot of our conversation is going to be about it, can I just say right now that this massive airport showdown scene, you know, scene sequence, well, you know, this was a comic geek's wet dream come true. was this not possibly the best battle scene there's been in a comic book movie?
Hands down, ever.
Is there one? Ever. I can't think of one that even comes close to it. And, you know, I don't care, you know, Heath Ledger, whatever, but don't care. This was and I'm not even a Marvel guy, and my jaw was on the floor by how much they were able to do. And I love that they kept mixing and matching characters. I love that. You know, it wasn't just the same two fighting each other. Then you'd mix them up. Then you'd mix them up again. I mean, the Spider-Man Giant Man thing alone. And they worked in an Empire Strikes Back reference. And I was like, hey, go for it, Disney.
Yeah.
Let's say that Giant Man thing was ruined for me like many, many months ago because of a Lego set. And Cade knows this too, because we'd kind of joked about it before about how Ant-Man had a quote bigger part in this movie than we had thought. But that was fantastic. That was fantastic.
Yeah, it didn't matter that you knew it was coming. When it happens, you still just go, "Holy shit! Giant Man is on this in the movie." Giant Man just showed up.
Paul Rudd's like, "Whoa."
And actually, to step away from Spidey just for a second, based on something that Jason said, perfect point to bring up is it was almost like the 1-2 punch of bringing Spider-Man in and then bringing Ant-Man in to the movie, which was just the right kind of levity and lightness that the movie probably needed at that point. So you're 100% correct about that. And also, anyone out there who didn't see Ant-Man last year, so they weren't as familiar with that character, well, you blew it. Go back and watch that movie, because it's worth watching. But Paul Rudd is just one of those really, truly gifted comic actors. So just watch him react to meeting Captain America and stuff like that. is just so much fun.
He said, "You're great, too. I know you. You're great, too."
Also, since just staying with the airport scene, and I'm sure, I think this has gotten around already that people are aware of this, but I would feel bad if I didn't mention it because it's one of my favorite comedy shows of all time.
I know what this is.
There is, and I thought I saw it, but I was like, no. And then I saw someone else confirm it when I was watching a video about the movie, like 2 days later. The Russo brothers, you know, obviously they worked on the previous Captain America movie, but their roots are in television. They worked on the TV show Community, which is why we've seen a couple Community actors show up in this movie, and the previous one as well, if I recall. I think Jim Rash has a brief moment in this movie. But better still, earlier in their career, they worked on the show Arrested Development, which is one of my all-time favorite shows, especially the first two seasons. Oh my god, if you watch this movie again, keep your eyes peeled during the airport scene. I think it's in the background of the scene when you see Captain America and Ant-Man in the frame, whatever. The Bluth stair car is at the airport. And if you've watched Arrested Development, you know exactly what I mean. If you haven't, then you've probably been ignoring me the last 30 seconds anyway. But that to me, that's one of the most awesome Easter eggs I've ever witnessed in one of these movies that has nothing to do with anything comic book related. It's like, oh my god, they got the Bluth stair car in the fucking thing. That's amazing. All right, I want to make sure I mention that. But Spider-Man, my god.
And his eyes. The eyes on that suit. Come on. They made Spidey eyes that squeeze in like he does in the comics. Like, you don't ever think about how they're going to make that work, but they did it. His eyes get small, they narrow in, they get big. They made an expression, a mask that makes expressions like Spider-Man does, and I was like, that's the best thing about that character.
Yes. Even though if you really think about it, especially the Spider-Man from the 60s, whether it was Ditko or Romita, his eyes being able to do that never really made a lot of sense. But we didn't care because it was so cool. And I love that they came up with a reason for them doing it here. And the fact, the genius, and I can't believe I'm going to use the word genius, but the genius of this movie is certain things that they created for this film, for this storyline, that really just explain things with Spider-Man so nicely and simply. Like the outfit. The fact that Tony Stark, you know, comes in, it's like, oh, well, now I understand why he would have an outfit that looks like that. because I couldn't, I wouldn't, a 15 or 16 year old couldn't possibly design an outfit that looked like that, but Stark Industries could, you know?
Yep.
You know, I loved the idea of making Tony Stark and Peter Parker kind of this almost like father-son, mentor-student kind of relationship. I really thought that was a novel idea that I didn't expect going into this because I wasn't, thankfully, I wasn't spoiled about that. And once I saw it playing out, I went, oh, this is really genius. This explains a whole lot of things, and we don't even need to worry about it for the next Spider-Man movie. I don't need to sit through Uncle Ben being shot again or anything. Please, let us not sit through that again. But
no, apparently the word is that they said they will not do an origin. This is the Spider-Man movie starts from here. It starts from the end of Captain America 3 is what they've said.
It's not going to be like the Waynes getting killed all over again.
I was going to say, what was missing here is that the opening credits should have been Uncle Ben. No, I'm just
kidding. Oh, God.
I'm saving it. I'm good. I mean, there's so much I loved about it. I mean, it made me remember the old comic books that I loved more than any Marvel comics was the old Spider-Man comics. It reminded me of the Spider-Man cartoon from the 60s, quite frankly. You know, the simplicity of the red and blue outfit and the eyes. I'm a tingle thinking about how much I enjoyed it. I actually want to go now and go see it again just for the Spider-Man stuff. That's how much I enjoyed it. And I'm a DC guy. So, okay. I'm going to take a breath now. So, I'm going to go from the lightest thing about the movie to one of the darkest things. Really briefly to get to that other point I've been waiting to make here. We've talked about a lot of the heroes here in one form or another. Pretty much all of them, I think. Pretty much. But we haven't really touched much on the villain. And I know the character from the comics, who Baron Zemo is, and what his outfit would look like. I appreciate the reasoning behind not doing that. And I was fine with that. I've always said in all our podcasts, I don't care if you make a change. It could be a huge change if it makes sense for the story. And for the story that they tell in this movie, this is the version of Zemo that makes sense, not a guy with the full face mask thing or the weird outfit he's got. So, and plus that guy's a really, is it Brule? Is that his last name?
Yeah.
He's a really good actor. And I really thought he brought something special to all of his villainous scenes right up until that final scene with, what's that? Actually, I guess it's not his last scene, but one of his scenes with Black Panther towards the end. Probably the only person in this movie I was kind of scratching my head, like, why did they bother getting you? Was Martin Freeman, quite frankly. I kept going, you went and got Martin Freeman for this? That's it? Really? Kind of a waste of Martin Freeman. But anyway. But back to the villain and the Winter Soldier. One of the major things about this movie, and I call it the twist we should have seen coming, but most people apparently didn't, including me, was the fact that the Winter Soldier actually murdered Stark's parents. And that's why I end up on Team Iron Man by the end of it, because of that, the shocking revelation, which they tease throughout this entire film. And unlike it being about someone's first name or something, it really works powerfully in this movie. And then, I mean, I think the audience I was in, I saw it like that opening night, like the following afternoon, there was a moment of like stunned silence in the film because we were like, oh my God, especially when he murders his mother, which is really rather horrible. So again, I thought they did such a great job with the villain's motivations and what his plan was and how he orchestrated it. And how it wasn't like seven different plans that, you know, one led to another, one didn't work. Here's plan A, here's plan C, here's plan 3, whatever. Everything led to what he wanted it to. And I just thought that was one of the really most clever and ingenious things about the film overall. What did you guys think of the villain stuff?
It was like you said earlier, the whole, how did I not see it coming? And I felt the same way. When it finally starts to fall into place with his plan, you're like, it was almost simple. It wasn't like something he overthought. He took the fewest pieces he could to get what he wanted out of the situation. And that was brilliant. That's a move that most Marvel villains, and where the Marvel villain villains fall apart, is it's their ideas are so over the top or so broad, they fall apart. This is one of those Marvel villains where you finally have a villain who you're like, oh, I can see where his motivation flows through. I can see his plan. I can see what he wants to happen out of this. And you're like, I understand it. I didn't see it coming. But now that I do, I can see where it all falls into place. You can see all the little bits and pieces. And it's like the thing, like the hotel room. You're seeing the hotel room, And then when you finally get to reveal what's going went on in the hotel room, you're like, okay, now I understand what happened there.
Right.
That's the kind of things that I think made the movie, that storyline, so interesting, was they gave you hints of the small little pieces. So when it all comes together, you can see how it was laid out. You see everything. And you're like, well, how did this get, you know how it got to where it got.
One of the things, and then I'll let Jason come in here. I'm sorry, Jason. I just want to mention here was sometimes when you watch a movie or TV show, you can get frustrated with the way red herrings are dealt with. You know, the bullshit things that is meant to mislead you, trick you, whatever. And they can sometimes annoy or anger an audience if they're not done well. And quite often they're not. I thought in this film, they did a really good job with it. There definitely were some major red herrings that totally misled us. But when you get to the crux of what everything is, it's like, oh, it makes sense. It works. Mm-hmm. And that can also be a problem. I mean, we've seen that be a problem in any number of other things over the years. But here, I was astonished that wow, they even that worked, because that could have easily gone totally awry, but I thought it really worked really well. Jason, you were going to say something.
I was going to compare Zemo's plan. You said that there's not many Marvel villains like that. I could think of one, and that's Kilgrave from Jessica Jones. How simple his plan was.
Right.
Movie
right.
universe. Movie, yeah, universe, just the movies, yeah. But yeah, his was the same way. But it, just in the movies, the villains are usually terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, outside and of Loki. For your,
yeah. Outside of Loki, basically, yeah.
And for your red herring thing, I like how they built up, like, oh, there's not just one Winter Soldier, there's five. And we might have ourselves a giant throwdown later on. And like, no, we're not going to do that, because Zemo took care of that himself.
I
like that.
I love that, and I don't remember who it was who said it. It might have been the Kevin Smith thing. It might have been another reviewer. I can't remember. It's like, it was one of those things, like, we should have known, because we didn't recognize any of the actors who were the other quote-unquote Winter Soldiers. Like, no, they wouldn't get a bunch of nobodies. So they're probably not going to play much of a part in this. But it didn't occur to me. I was totally going along with it. But so, since talking about a villain and their motivations. I think at this point, it would be weird if I didn't at least talk a little bit and contrast how many plot elements this film weirdly has in common with Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. I mean, you know, I already devoted an entire podcast to that film without any of you guys, sorry. about a month ago. By the way, P.S., if anyone who missed that one, please go track it down and listen, because I really think it's pretty good. It's episode number 123. But back to this one. I think it's impossible to ignore how many things that they have in common. Whether it be really basic or really specific. I mean, the fact that both movies, you know, both introduce a hero that we have not yet seen in a live-action film before, as well as reintroduce and reboot an extremely popular character that we've seen countless times before. That's a little strange. But the fact that the movies center on a main conflict between your two main superheroes that are... And we find out that it's actually all puppetry by this master villain behind the scenes... is a kind of weird thing that they also have in common. However, the problem is Marvel's advantage is, well, they were able to build to this over several films in several years. They took their time, it built up to it, and it worked. And DC, for whatever reason, or should I say Warner Brothers, I keep forgetting, it's not DC, it's Warner Brothers, felt, oh, we need to hurry up and catch up. So instead of taking their time, which pretty much anyone who talks about these movies says, why didn't they just take their time? What difference does it make how many years it takes to get to it? They decide to try to do it all in one movie, and that's why it, by and large, it doesn't work very well. I mean, we've spent this podcast talking about how much we understood both Captain America and Iron Man's reasonings for their opposition to each other and why they eventually fight, and then the huge fight at the end, which comes down to something more core and real about the loss of one's parents. These are things that also play a part in Batman v Superman, but they're just not handled as well. Even during that entire fight, you're thinking, I still am not clear why they have to be fighting, or why couldn't they do this, or why couldn't they do that, and, oh, it's the same first name, that's what? So, and there's no one who hates to say this more than me. You know, the guy who wears Batman and Superman socks, the guy who's thanking God he didn't go with his decision a couple years ago, I almost got like a Batman symbol and a Superman symbol on both of my wrists as tattoos, and I didn't do it because I heard about this movie, and I said, wait, if that movie should suck, people are always going to think I got this these tattoos based on some really crappy movie. Thank God I didn't do it. But I'm not ripping Batman v Superman to build this movie up, because I already spent an entire podcast talking about Batman v Superman already anyway. And there are things I like about it, but you can't think about and talk about this movie and not at least acknowledge that one. It's too weird a coincidence to have those two movies. You know, what's even more fascinating is that the fact that a year ago or whatever it was, these movies were actually scheduled to come out on the same day. and then Warner Brothers decided to move theirs to March. Oh my God, if they come out the same day, that would have been so lovely and embarrassing. It would have been amazing. Okay, if any of you want to say anything about that, feel free. Otherwise, we can move on to the next thing.
I'm good without talking about it.
I know, that's why I was able to do that on the podcast. All right, I'm going to assume I've already sucked all the air out of the room. So I'm going to throw this to you guys and give myself a break. We spent this entire hour plus talking about how much we enjoyed and loved this movie. Now, outside of maybe a little sniping about the music, which I personally have always had an issue with all the Marvel movies, like, why don't they do better music for these? Like, really cool, memorable music. Like, each hero should get their own theme or something. That would be so awesome, but they kind of... And if they do, I can't tell, because it all sounds kind of... Eh. Music aside, is there anything about the movie that any of you could see maybe being done differently or done better or just didn't quite hit it for you? I can only think of one minor, teeny tiny thing, but I'd rather listen to you guys than hear me talk anymore. Cade, well, or Jason,
I have nothing.
Or Vicky.
I have nothing.
Wow. I guess my only...
I can't think of anything.
My guess would be... My thing would be the way they use the title cards. Maybe too big.
I love that. Shut up.
I don't need to see Belgium in 8 foot tall letters. I guess. Wait,
have you watched Preacher yet? Wait till you watch Preacher. Oh, by the way, before she said, I would personally love it if the person who tends to be the most positive about things is the one who comes up with something negative here. Oh, it would be like Christmas coming early for me. So, Vicky. come on, Vicky.
Kind of my only main problem with this is I don't think it necessarily passes the Bechdel test, if you guys know what that is. It's kind of like a test used for movies. It's basically, is there more than one female character in the movie, and do they have a conversation about something that's other than a man?
So this is Vicky's nice way of saying it's a sausage fest, is basically what she's saying. Which, it's just true.
Yeah.
It absolutely is. I mean, there are, you only have, you do have a handful of female characters in it. You know, you've got You got Natasha, you've got Wanda, and you've got Sharon Carter, which would have been the one thing I would have pointed to as being maybe the slight ick, the very, very slight ick factor of, wait, is Steve Rogers smooching it up with the niece, grandniece of his dead girlfriend, or is that not just a little weird? But it's not that
actually
weird.
In the comics, they totally had a thing.
Oh no, I'm sure that doesn't mean, you know what, it would be weird if I was reading a comic too. Comics don't absolve it. Comics can be icky as well. It didn't bother me. It bothered me more that they killed Peggy Carter, because it was like the same week that I see her funeral, then the show gets canceled on ABC, and it's like, really?
Don't even get me started on that.
Fucking bastards. Yeah, I guess that would be true. There just weren't that enough female characters in the movie to even have scenes like that, as far as I can recall. So, but you know, if that's the worst thing about the movie, considering it's a movie that's about Iron Man fighting Captain America, I won't rip on it too much for something like that. But it's good to point it out regardless. It's no Jessica Jones in that regard.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think of anything else. I mean, I love the movie. I enjoyed both post-credit scenes. You know, obviously the Wakanda one that we talked about earlier, because that really is giving us... I like that both post-credit scenes are liftoffs or introductions to those characters' movies. Because the Wakanda one is definitely... Well, that's our opening to the Black Panther movie. And then the Spider... Excuse me. Oh, I was about to belch into the podcast. The Spider-Man one, which is really amazing, because that movie is not going to be released by Disney. It's going to be a Sony Pictures thing, but they still did a Spider-Man Will Return, like with a James Bond movie or something. And I love the little gadget thing at the end with the Spidey signal, which is so retro. I haven't read a Spider-Man comic in years, but I'm remembering that from like a long time. I remember having a toy like that when I was like 7 or 8 years old. So I was amazed when I saw that. Such a good one.
Yeah. Hey. I have one more thing that I liked, and then I'll be done. And that's what we get the Captain America's No You Move speech, but it's not delivered by Captain America. But it was still cool to hear, and it comes at a point where Cap is questioning about what he should do, and as soon as he hears it, you know, of course, he's like, I can't sign.
Oh, right, okay. I was trying to remember what the heck you were talking about for a second there. I was like, wait, what was he talking about? And then I remembered. Also, you know, I'm going to pick something really weird and random that I kind of enjoyed about this movie for some strange reason. Obviously, when we get to this movie, this is kind of the culmination of most of the previous Marvel movies. Obviously, we don't have Thor or Hulk in this. But at least they're referenced in the movie, and it made sense for them not to be there anyway. And apparently that Thor movie is going to take place mostly in outer space, which is going to be crazy. Is it weird that I kind of love the fact that they got William Hurt back to be Thunderbolt Ross, since the one Marvel movie he's in is kind of the one they seem to everyone kind of like forgets about, which is the, I guess it was the Ed Norton version of the Hulk, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah, it was.
So I really like that they brought him back into it. I also found... Now, I wish I'd written it down. There's some weird legal issues with the Hulk as far as being a lead in the movie, and that's actually the real reason why they won't do a Hulk standalone movie. He'll just appear in other films. But I can't remember the details of it. But it kind of surprised me. But apparently there are some legal issues that he can't be... They can't deal with him being the lead of a film. Which is fine. I think he works better as a supporting character, apparently, anyway. But I didn't know that until, like, very recently. I wish I made note of it for the podcast, and I could have informed the listeners. But, of course, now I've just frustrated them instead. Anyway. But this was just, I mean, gosh darn it. I mean, two of the best comic book movies I've seen this year are both Marvel, and they're from totally different sides of the universe, Deadpool and now Civil War. I mean, holy crap, the stuff was good this year so far.
Yep. I watched Deadpool again this weekend, really. And it's amazing how totally different they are tonally. But it's really, Marvel is doing well with the movies. It's amazing how good these movies are. You expect a drop off, but they've gotten so much, they've gotten really good talent to get behind them. They're still attracting top actors to come in and do these movies. And I'm sure money's a big part of it, but still, some there's top actors who are doing comic book movies. And when you think about that, sometimes you're like, I can't believe this is actually something that's happening.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, as if we're talking about all Marvel movies as opposed to the ones that were that are fall within the DC umbrella, I mean Disney umbrella. Oof, DC umbrella, that'd be weird. Let's see what happens with the X-Men Apocalypse movie. That I've heard some shaky things about that, so that could derail things. We'll see. Maybe not. There is some not so great buzz going on in some quarters with the Doctor Strange movie, but that's so early. So I guess we should wait and see with that one as well. But right now, they can do no wrong. They can just print money, is what they're doing pretty much. All right. If there's anything else, I don't think there is. We will be getting together again, hopefully later this week, to talk about all the season finales of the shows that we usually talk about on this podcast. You know, your Flash, your Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, which we've all already seen. So I'm assuming we can't hint about anything here. All I'm going to say is yay, looking forward. Let's just say I'm really looking forward to that podcast. I have to find some celebratory music to play during that segment. Oh, if only they had killed him. But I am going to probably play a clip of my previous podcast. Like, hey, look, my dream almost came true. Anyway. Back to here. All right, so if there's nothing else, I guess I should start wrapping things up.
Yes, put a wrap on 1:30, please.
1:30. Gosh, I hope we put this out before the next one. All right, so if you enjoyed this podcast, you would probably enjoy participating on our Facebook page. You can find us on Facebook, where the Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed. You can also rate and review us. Every rating and review helps us get noticed by folks who are searching for podcasts about various TV shows and apparently even movies from time to time. But I think I should change the name of the podcast every once in a while. And finally, you can also follow us on the Twitter. The handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. Yeah, that's about it. I'm glad that we were all able to get together here and talk about this movie. I'm sorry Dan wasn't here to participate as well. I know he had something interesting and negative to say about the movie that was going to be major fodder for discussion. We'll never know what it is, or maybe he'll bring it up on the next podcast. We could talk about it then. Who knows? But once again, as always, I want to thank you guys for participating and letting folks know how you felt about Captain America: Civil War.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us again. Yes, we're gonna go break out Dan
in the raft. Yeah. All right. Well, with all that said, good night to all of you, and of course, good night Dan as well.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Wait! I can't believe I just did an entire hour and a half podcast about this movie. And I didn't mention my favorite thing in the entire film. How did I forget to mention my favorite moment in this entire movie? A little shocked no one else said it either.
What is it, Scott?
Okay, let's go back to the best moment in the movie, which is, of course, the airport showdown scene. Oh my God, the scene, the interaction between Spider-Man and Captain America. When Cap says, hey, you know, kid, where are you from? And he's like, I'm from Queens. Like, I'm from Brooklyn. This is a New Yorker talking here. The audience erupted. We went more nuts for that moment than anything else in the entire film. The fact
I'm going to let you know, my head, the thing going on in my head when that went down, I'm like, Scott's going to love that.
And I mean, And what's funnier is that I'm a Brooklyn guy, and if you're someone who's a native New Yorker and you've grown up your entire life in Brooklyn, you're kind of, for some reason, taught to hate Queens. I don't know why. I have no idea why. It's very irrational. But anyway, in this movie, that was just, I lost. I was like, oh my God. I think like when you're at a concert and the singer mentions where you're from, it's like, oh, from, you know, it's like, yay. But it was fucking so awesome. I love that moment. Because in the middle of all this, in the middle of this insanity, this battle, and where people's motivations are not even clear at times, you can have this pure moment between these two people. And I only wish that somehow Captain America could also make an appearance in that next Spider-Man movie just because of that moment. But I hope to see those two interact again at some point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe future. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there because it would be weird for me to do an entire podcast about that movie and not mention my favorite fucking scene. All right, back to the music.